Simon.
Hello, Jim. We return.
Yeah, you know, we're recording today on March 25th, 325.
Yes.
In the year 325, gladiatorial combat was outlawed in the Roman Empire, which begs the question, wow. Simon, how often do you think about the Roman Empire?
A lot now that I've been primed to think about it because I've been told men think about it all the time.
I didn't.
So before that moment in time, though, I don't know, like infrequently, and now, I don't know, like weekly.
I know. It's like trying to draw the causal relationship, the arrow, which direction does it point? Like, are we thinking about it because of TikTok or?
It's definitely because the media is making a big deal about it. Yeah. I barely think about the Roman Empire otherwise.
Yeah, me neither. But, seriously, though, I was going to come up with the perfect introduction for today's episode and guest. I mean, flawless, pristine, absolute perfection. Then I thought, fuck it. If we wait until I get a perfect intro, we're never going to actually get to the episode because it's impossible to reach perfection. So we just have to move forward with something that will work. Which I know it's going to work, Simon, because you wrote today's intro as opposed to me. So we're actually going to get a good intro this time. So here it goes. Today, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room. That is the modern marketing measurement dilemma. In an era where privacy changes have pushed us away from deterministic attribution, we have all jumped in the escape pods and miraculously ended up at the same destination as we all look to build our own MMMs or design incrementality tests. Many will say these are table stakes initiatives for the modern marketing measurement practitioner, which is quite the tongue twister to say that three times.
Oh, it is. Say that five times fast. That's a hard one.
And they may, yes. Yeah, and they may be right, right? But it's also leading to a very homogenous industry where we all seek to outgun our peers, not through innovation, but by amping up the volume and frequency of measurement. So today's guest has constantly looked to challenge the way we think about measurement. He has served as a trusted advisor to many of the world's leading CMOs. In 2021, he authored his book, Converted, The Data-Driven Way to Win Customers' Hearts. He's a faculty member at Wharton Executive Education, a renowned keynote speaker, has spent the past 13 years with Google, and in his current role, is the chief strategist at Google. Welcome to the show, Neil Hoyne.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thank you for having me. And based on where that introduction was going, I thought we were going to do analytics and decision-making by combat.
Yeah,
I wonder. I've never looked it up. I wonder if that was the approach. You're in a meeting and you're disagreeing. They didn't have PowerPoint slides back then, and you're disagreeing with one of your peers, and it'd be like, we'll settle this in combat.
Click the ring.
Perhaps before the year 325. Yeah,
God, it would probably be more entertaining for everybody else in the company to watch than building another MMM. But thank you for that.
You know, it would really make you think twice about choosing your KPI. Like, you really need to believe in it if you're going to battle to the death.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
God, I was gonna say, are there any like MMM readouts where I would battle to the death or at least hold my conviction?
That's the beauty of it, is that you never get to that point. It's just the conversation,
right?
It's like, Simon, how well do you believe that output?
Not enough to fight to the death.
No,
is the answer.
Okay, we'll keep going with the status quo. Maybe things haven't changed as much as we think.
Maybe.
Neil, we usually like to open up the episodes with a little bit of background about our guests. So maybe if you could just tell us the 60-second synopsis about who you are, how you came to be, where you are, what you find interesting in today's measurement challenges.
Sure. I mean, here's the way I describe it in 60 seconds. I won't take you through the whole history of it. I really do two things. One is I work intimately with the data to build the models and to understand what's actually happening in the world of marketing. The other half is figuring out what companies actually do with it or not do with it. And it's often that gap to say we're creating wonderful measurement solutions as an industry, as a profession. And then oftentimes you have that friction of getting companies to actually adopt that data and listen to that decision. And it's just really that intersection between, I'd like to say, the very quantitative side of our lives, things that we can prove and understand, and then that very human side that looks at the implications of what we're changing, whether it's smaller team sizes or greater budgets, and how we actually make progress across companies given those constraints.
Awesome. And you obviously, you have such a wealth of knowledge, and I was very fortunate to come across you years ago. We were both speaking at the same event, but I have just found your knowledge inside over the years to be profound and perhaps
thank you, sir.
Independent of the average. What I've seen out there, in the sense of, there's a lot of ways that everyone will think in a homogenous capacity, and you often have there's always the platitude. Well, when they zig, we all zag. And you're like, how do you zag? Like, what does that actually mean? Like, what is it? It's like, that's a cool thing to say, but what does that look like in practicality? And the experience that I've had with you over the years is that you've got a really good pulse on the human psychology side of measurement and how we should think differently about things. And just given the fact that you do have this robust knowledge and that you're talking with all these leaders all the time, that synopsis up front, that was really sort of cherry picked from our pre-call of where we know that you've got where you're really thinking right now. But we'd love to hear from you about what are the biggest challenges that you believe are facing the modern measurement practitioner.
I mean, there's a lot of challenges, and it depends on what side you look at. I think when you talk to the measurement practitioners, they're going to go through the list, something that all the readers are going to understand, about the implications of privacy, about not having enough budgets, about uncertainty in the world at large. Those are all fine and good. Mm-hmm. I think when we take a step back and we look at the corporate level, what are companies doing in marketing and how are they looking at marketing measurement? That's where things become a little bit more interesting. Mm-hmm. And the way that I generally like to look at is pre-COVID. God, it's almost sounding cliche that we put this point in time, but I think it's real. Is that I worked with a lot of companies where measurement was defined as doing what we did last year, but slightly better. Mm-hmm. We had these same techniques, but maybe we're going to iterate them on, maybe we're going to bring one more data set in. And the goal generally, and I hate to say this, was you didn't want to rock the boat. And for companies that were doing fine, that were comfortable with their growth rate, they didn't want to screw it up. And there were some companies I worked with where if you went from 2012 to 2018, it was literally the same sales strategy. Mm-hmm. Their strategy sessions had to be incredibly easy. They just took the same deck, updated the numbers. Maybe this year, instead of 2%, we're going to grow at 2.5%. And then COVID came along.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, we all bear witness to how companies decided to react with gross uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Some companies had a path forward, or so they thought. I remember Patagonia shut down their stores for a month in March, which is kind of funny. They're like, yeah, we're just going to close down for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Why? Consultancies were saying, McKinsey, I poke on them every because they put out this study that was pretty ambitious in April of 2020. They said, well, based on our expert analysis, in June, best case, everything's back to normal. We'll have herd immunity. Remember that phrase?
Yeah.
Worst case scenario is herd immunity for everybody by December, and then the world is back to normal. And so everybody was making predictions, but they were doing so in a time of uncertainty with data. Lo and behold, a couple of years later, we're emerging out of COVID. And even though COVID has gone away, there's still that feeling of unease with a lot of companies where they're like, what's happening? Are we in a recession? Are we in a soft landing? What are we going to do next? There's inflation. Do we hire? Do we fire people? And you see these corporate oscillations one after the next trying to figure out what to do. And they look back at the data people like, hey, you data people, sort this out for us. And I think that's the largest constraint is that the measurement people are trying to remove uncertainty that nobody can necessarily attack. And you say, well, if there's more uncertainty, if we don't know if we should invest more or less or go into this market or charge more or less, what is the role of measurement in data? Now, the interesting part about it is that a lot of companies have stepped up to say, we're tired of dealing with this uncertainty. We're looking at data and analytics, and I see more programs being funded and being trusted than ever before. They want to improve their competencies. But I also think the task that's been handed along with it is what's making it very difficult, is that they're coming to these teams saying, we'll give you all the money in the world. Tell me the future. And I think that there's that practical thing where the measurement people are, don't want to be like, no, we can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they also want to say, well, these are the limits of what we can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. And this is where it becomes really interesting, is that some companies are having that honest conversation to the point that it came up in the introduction. This is what we can do that's better. You're now finally listening to us measurement people. We're going to help you be better. Thank you. There's another group that's saying, what you're now asking our measurement team to do is not technically achievable. Mm-hmm. You're asking for absolute certainty. You're asking for the removal of risk. You're asking for decisions that are quickly made at a 99% confidence interval without enough budget to test everything. And the interesting thing is that there's some analytics organizations that can't bring themselves to share that concept with their leadership. They're looking at it. Here's my moment to step up. And instead, they're like, but I don't want to tell them that there's practical limits to what they're asking. And so companies are going down this path to say, we're investing more in analytics ever before. We take it more seriously. But the projects that they've tasked those teams are so monumental that I actually think that they'll get fewer results than when they had more modest expectations. And so just as we overcorrected on the hiring, let's hire everybody, and then we have to lay everybody off in tech. Now it's the, well, let's just go ahead and do everything with measurement and analytics, and I worry about the next year or two where it actually pulls back, where they said, we dumped all this money and what happened? And I'm hoping that there's not an overcorrection on the analytical side to say, we didn't see the ROI we expected because the expectations could never be reached.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting.
That's a lot all in one, Simon. I'm sorry.
No. I love that. It's such an interesting pendulum that you're talking about there. And the whole time I'm thinking about this idea of measurement practitioners have been knocking on the door for such a long time to say, give us the next at bat. And now the CMO is looking at them going, you're leading off. Let's go.
And they're expecting there, and they're expecting a grand slam.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the ninth inning, go. And you're like, okay, I wasn't really prepared for this moment.
This is more extreme. This is taking a farm league team. This is taking a junior high baseball team and saying, look, we built you a stadium. Go play at the professional level.
Sure.
And here's the thing. If the managers are saying, we know this shit's really hard, then that's one thing. On the other hand, they're like, no, you have all the money you need. What's stopping you? Just practice more. And the realities of that situation are what's going to confound them.
Or to continue the baseball analogy and throwing in some money ball, it's like when Brad Pitt hired the team that he wanted, but then the manager refused to play them the way he wanted them to be played to follow the strategy, where it's like a lot of this boils down to, some executive wants help to make a decision. They want to reduce the uncertainty, or they want the data team to just tell them the answer. But they're not willing to, not willing to actually change the thing that they were going to do anyway, right? I see what you're saying, but I don't think it's going to work that way. My gut tells me this, so let's just do it this way.
Yeah, the irony too, the gut is driving measurement decisions. By the way, for all of our international listeners out there, substitute any other sport in with baseball, it works all the same. There's nothing proprietary but baseball.
Yes, cricket ball.
But it works. Pick cricket, pick basketball. It's all the same. Managers and owners not necessarily understand the complexity of what's happening during the game itself. And that's, in some measurement organizations, I guess this is what it comes down to. They're happy to take the money. This is more money that they've seen. This is more hope. This is more focus than they've seen. Mm-hmm. And it's leading to a bunch of interesting projects. A lot of companies that are offering these services. More tests are being run. All things that are great. And you can imagine having any type of team and saying, we're finally going to give you the money to develop yourself. And that's a reason for anybody to celebrate. Here's a brand new stadium. Who wouldn't be happy? Yeah. But on the other hand, what I'm looking for is 12 to 18 months down the road, there's going to be a correction for it where they say, where are the results that we were promised? Mm. And by the way, this isn't unique to measurement. I also expect it to happen in some pockets of AI, where the expectations are so high that I don't think they can be reached even with AI's enormous potential. And it's the same thing with data and with measurement. And so part of this, really, I think what we're having here is that conversation to say, if you realize this is happening, then you can start to make adjustments for it and be better off.
We're almost the peak of inflated expectations to a degree around this moment in time, because I know you were highlighting COVID there, but COVID didn't happen it was a massive life-changing moment for everyone in the world, right? This milestone moment, business changed fundamentally. But that was simultaneously occurring along with the large-scale privacy changes that were impacting all of these features and functions. So we were saying, well, we would do the same thing we did last year. I'm like, yeah, because that was in the era where deterministic attribution was, it wasn't perfect, and we sort of clouded our vision to that idea. We were just like, well, it's pretty good. But then the ugly, hard truth truly came out, where we looked at it and said, you have less than half the signal at this moment in time. So there is the majority of signal that you're seeing, even for these platforms, that's all modeled. And if you put any kind of stock into this at this moment in time, you're going to make bad decisions. And I think that dealing with that combined with the business uncertainty and the having not gone through a pandemic previously and understanding what type of remnants remain coming out the other side, those are the pieces that we just don't know how to forecast the future of. But when we talk about the homogeneity, well, that's where we end up at this point of, okay, we've got this new stadium, we're going out there. Well, you're expected to hit the ball like everyone else is, and hitting the ball like everyone else is at this moment in time seems to be doing MMM and incrementality. And that's been, you know, the big, that's the MMM hub. That's what Jim is baking his whole next
trying
final.
To get everyone to do it.
Exactly. But is that like what, how do we get to this point? But how are you thinking about this? And Jim, maybe because Jim's always my MMM. He's the MMM guy. I know. Live up to the title, Jim. If you want to expand on that in terms of how you're thinking about MMM at this moment in time to get Neil's take, I'd love to hear from you too.
Whose take are you looking for? I'm sorry.
I was saying, Jim, if you want to expand on that, because I was sort of butchering the scope of setting up the MMM discussion. So it's good this isn't live. This is good.
Well, it's recorded in front of a live studio audience.
It is. But, that's right. It is.
So like kind of digging into that idea of the homogeneity, and we talked about this a little bit last week on the pre-call, but there's this idea that, okay, everyone's moving to the same stuff now. Like, okay, now, quote unquote, everyone's doing MMM and incrementality or conversion lift studies and things like that. And that just means that, you know, everyone's staying level or no one's kind of innovating there. Do you feel that that's maybe what's happening, Neil? And do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm bad at predictions, because if you asked me 5 or 6 years ago, I would have said MMMs are dead. Everything will be individual level. And then you saw the implications of privacy and you're like, oh shit. let's talk about this both ways. First, Simon, to your question about the privacy implications at the same time as COVID. Yes, it happened. I don't think executives by and large gave a shit. They knew it was happening, but they were like, marketers, that's your problem. Go get me my ROI. The methods and tools that you use are not a concern of mine, or not a material one, with the exception of maybe a handful of industries where marketing is all they do. Mm. And so marketers are left to say, well, what's in our toolbox? What can we finally do? And so MMMs have seen a resurgence. Now, where I'd say it's good is that MMMs have proven to be a useful approach to understanding the marketing, understanding media allocation, what's driving performance in your business. And so I think it's a great, you picture it as a group of people around the table, and MMM is someone that I'd want to listen to and someone that I'd want to invest in and I want to look at. The larger question, which I think you get to, is where does it go? And this is, again, the question between leadership, strategy, and tactics, is that I think some companies are like, we're just going to dump all of our money into MMMs. Mm. And I have to question, when we go, we talk about marketing, we talk about reasons to believe. What is the reason to believe that you will be able to build an MMM better than the rest of your vertical and be able to build it in a way where it lends to a strategic advantage? And I flesh this out because every company has this idea to say, if our attribution model, if our MMM is better than our competitors, then money will fall from the sky. It will not. You will be subject to all the same constraints around targeting, creative responsiveness, granularity that everybody else is, unless you have a way to make a major technical innovation and then hope to God nobody on your team that knows that innovation goes to a competitor when they hand out a pile of money. And so I go back and I say, even with the MMM in place, which is where all your measurement and focus is, tell me why your company is going to be able to execute on those results better and faster than a competitor who can build a roughly equivalent MMM. Because if we're going to talk about marketing and we're going to talk about a competitive advantage, you're going to tell me either one, it's coming from the MMM, which is a case I just made. Tell me why I believe you can establish a competitive advantage through an MMM. Because if you can do that, I don't even need a product. I'll go to Sand Hill Road and I'll raise a whole bunch of money from the VC guys being like, my product is average, but my MMM is my secret sauce. They never buy into that. What it really is execution of the results of that MMM, execution of the results of your data and your measurement, which is to say, do you have a strategy, again, to make your company more data-driven than your competitors, to be able to move faster on the insights of these tools? And I don't think over the past 10 years, companies have spent enough time trying to address it. They focused more on the tactics, thinking that the poor measurement people will build this great MMM, and then suddenly we'll get in a room and we'll all listen to it? Like that's suddenly going to happen? Or that we're going to run a test and everybody's going to be thrilled with the results and move forward? These organizational frictions are still there. Mm. They're just not being talked about as much. And so I think the tactics, if they change, I think that they're appropriate. I think companies do need MMMs because of the privacy changes. They do need to run more tests. They could use more first-party data, and they certainly need to know how to attack and appreciate privacy. But even with those solutions solved, if nobody in the organization is willing to move on the recommendations of that data, then those traditional roadblocks still remain in place, that people have their feelings and their intuitions. And I worry all this is for naught. And this is really what ties it together, is that if the organization isn't willing to make more data-driven decisions, then all they're looking at is to say, we're making decisions in the same way, but we're dumping 10 times more money into something we're not fully comfortable listening to. And so then I have to have that conversation. I say, I appreciate all your money, but if you're not going to listen to me, if you're not going to make 10 times more data-driven decisions because of what I'm telling you to do, then what are we really doing as an organization?
Yeah, and it boils.
And by the way, I'm really a positive guy on this stuff. It's just, we need to have these talks where everyone's like, ah, our new software tool will fix this, or our new consultancy or agency will fix this. Yes, if you listen to them.
Exactly.
Right. And I haven't seen that yet.
What's the Avinash Kaushik rule, the 90-10 rule, every 10% of your investment that you put into technology and tools, you spend 90% on humans.
Yeah, but most companies get that exactly backwards, right? Most companies spend 90% on the tools and 10% on the people. But you're right. It all comes down to being a people problem, right? We have to, it's behavioral change. It's how do we get people to behave differently or change their patterns of how they make decisions, which is so much harder to fix than just saying, oh, let's go spend $1 million on this software. Then I can check the box and say,
it's hard.
You know?
It is impossibly hard. And to all the data and analytical people, like you guys, like those listening, I share in your pain, and I wish I could go to a company and be like, look, the data says do X. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to sell this to you? Why do I need to make you feel good about it? And this aspiration, by the way, there's somewhere there's a company that they just listen to you. There's a few. But by and large, you're like, God, my company, I shouldn't have to do this. Mm-hmm. The data is what the data is. People should listen to me. That's just not how we're wired. And so part of it is on both sides saying to the people that are leading with the heart and their intuition where data scares the shit out of them is to say, you have to trust it a little bit more. And for all those people on the data side is you have to understand where these people are coming from, that this stuff intimidates them. They're going to see the readout of your MMM to say what's driving what the ROI is. And they're going to get lost when you try to explain how you built that MMM. And for them, they feel intimidated. They feel like their skills are no longer appreciated, that AI is going to come in and wipe them off because all they're doing is following some model that was built, not their experience. Mm. And we need to be able to bring all those people together in order to make change. And it's just a part. If it's uncomfortable to anybody, this is a part that's been neglected by analytics for such a long period of time. And the stakes could not be higher. If you're able to nail this now, your budgets will continue to grow because you're going to be able to demonstrate that growth now that you're properly funded. If they don't, I worry about the organizational legacy of people saying, hey, remember that time we gave a lot of money to data and nothing happened? And then someone's going to draw some weird correlation budget that we spent on analytics, ROI of marketing, and it's going to be unchanged. And people are going to say, oh, well, we tried giving more money to data and that didn't work. And that's going to be the wrong lesson. It's just we have to implement it in a different way.
Yeah.
It really raises the point that like as analysts and data people, we have to be better storytellers. We have to be able to change hearts and minds, not through slides of tables of numbers, but like telling a story, like getting buy-in.
Well, I think better storytellers, and this is part of it, but it's better relationship building. So you can have a greater degree of empathy for the situation, the role that somebody's in. And I think Neil brought up a really salient point there, and that is this broad, some folks will say it's optimism. I actually think there's a sense of dread around the AI movement. And when you see folks like Sam Altman come out and say 95% of marketing functions will be done away with by generative AI solutions, there is a very real fear at this moment in time of I cannot let the machines do my work for me, or I cannot let these models do my work for me. I have to show that I have some kind of differentiation in the market, because I look around and this is true right now. Like I look around and go, God, I know so many people have been laid off in the last year in the measurement space and in the market, and it's very concerning when you sort of feel like I'm maybe aiding and abetting the machines taking over my job in a sense of allowing, you know, I'm opening the door and welcoming them in and saying, here you go, please take a look at everything here. And I maybe that's where some of the fear at this moment is coming from. Although one thing an idea I want to frame up here is one of the challenges I've found with MMM, and I love thinking about MMM, and I'm not as strong as a technical practitioner as Jim is, but I've always found the trouble with being the MMM gap. And the MMM gap is it's that void that exists between, here's the output of an MMM, and it will say something like, you should move $15,000 from bottom of the funnel, branded search, to top of the funnel, YouTube. And you tell that to the media manager and they go, oh, okay, well, I'm running a bunch of campaigns here and I've got, you know, like a target return on ad spend that I need to have at the campaign level, which is calculated through this deterministic or somewhat model, you know, attribution feedback loop that I have within the platform. I can't make these things speak the same language, because if you tell me invest more here, I don't know if I'm aiming toward the right path. I don't know if it's like driving blindfold, and it's like, we'll tell you in 100 meters if you're still on the road. You're like, I'm going to need more tactile feedback than that at this moment. Like, I have to know, like, every couple meters, like, you're veering to the right, you're veering to the left. That is a very real gap, and perhaps why also we see this resistance, because there is this idea of, like, cool, it satiates the CFO, it satiates the CMO. It does not satiate the media manager in the sense of it may get them more budget here, but it doesn't give them any better guidelines to manage against, and they want what they used to have, which was that deterministic feedback loop. Do you think there's any truth to that in terms of the sentiment within the marketing community around MMM?
The tools are imperfect. They're the best that we can come up with to understand behavior. The way that I frame it to people is that understanding human behavior, and this is not from an organizational sense, but from a consumer, how many impressions, how many TV ads, how many emails, how many word of mouth mentions to drive behavior is incredibly complex and highly variable. Mm. It's incredibly difficult. We even think about ourselves. Why did we buy that product? We could probably write an infinite list of different things that went into factor our decisions. Now, we always hope that there's that major decision point and something we can pay attention to. But MMMs and tools like them are really our best guess at understanding what's happening. And give me a second. Are they perfect? No, they're not. But here's the thing. Even if we had a perfect MMM that was responsive, that could do everything on a day-by-day basis, on a channel, by keyword level, then everybody would come in and say, great, those are table stakes for every business. How do I get better than this? And we'll go wander ourselves into things, the same issues again, because there's these adoption issues of it. And so I understand the direction that companies want to go. And this is really where the organization comes around it, is to say, how do we want to make decisions with that uncertainty? Now, I'm going to borrow your metaphor here, Simon, because I don't want to bring up sports again. That's too easy. But people will be like, hey, we're driving the car on the road. I can't see a goddamn thing. You told me that the road is straight, but that was 10 minutes ago. Are we still on the road, or am I driving through somebody's field? Because the earlier you can tell me, the better. And we think about it from an individual lens, where we're like, shit, if I'm ran off the road, this is a problem for me. And I guess what? And I say, guess what? You're in a convoy with 1,000 other cars and they all have the exact same information. Some figured out where the road stopped 200 meters ago. Others maybe 50.
Yeah.
But we're all in the same consequence. And the goal here is not to stay alive. The goal is simply to stay alive longer than your competitors. That is it. With consumer behavior. Look, I live in auction land, right? The auction is not saying you get on the top of Google because you're perfect. That'd be an aspirational goal. We're nowhere near that. You're on the top of the auction because you are better than the competitors that you have. You're better, you're more relevant to customers. And that's the same thing that I look at, is to say, all these tools, if the expectation is that they're absolutely perfect and will give you that minute-by-minute update, okay, keep waiting. Maybe in a couple hundred years, we'll figure it out. Maybe Sam's predictions on AI will come true. I don't think so. But where I look at it more is to say, consumers will recognize you if you're able to reach them in a better way than their competitors, who are all subject to the same constraints you are. And when you think about it, not just within your own realm and your own limitations, and you think about it to say, has anybody solved this in our industry? No. Does anybody have remember that line that was really popular before we had other things to do, which I was like, I want the right message to the right consumer at the right time. This one-to-one personalization. Shit, who wouldn't love that? I would love that as an AI function.
Yes, please.
I don't even want to talk. Guys, just give me a teleprompter and it will say, Neil, this is what you say now. This is the best thing that the universe can conceive that you can possibly say. That's never going to happen. All I can say is, I want to say something slightly better than my competitor. And that's enough for me to grow and to be happy. And that's never going to satisfy the data science people who are looking at there and be like, here's the list of all the error that I have in my model. I have to say, I'm not calibrating it on that. I'm calibrating to say, do we believe our analytical practices are better than the other people that we're competing with?
Mm.
If they are, I'm happy. That's it. They may not be responsive enough for me. They never will be. That's what pushes the industry forward. That's what challenges us to take on these things of making these models better and more granular. But at the end of the day, I want to say, am I doing better? Because if I'm doing better than my competitors, then I'm going to see a higher growth rate than them. I'm hopefully going to see lower churn. I'm going to see better ROI in my marketing. All the benefits will come forward. But it all starts with saying, competitively, we're all fighting for the same consumer at the same moment, offering our best line to those consumers about why they should trust and why they should buy. And so I just want to know that I'm slightly better. My reason to believe isn't that I can build a perfect model ever. My reason to believe is I believe I can build a perfect model. I can build a better model and I can implement them in a better way than the other people that are trying to reach the same person for the same dollar.
Yeah.
That's all I can do.
And this idea that we'll ever get to this perfect model that is 100% accurate and it's going to tell us exactly how many pennies to put into every channel and it's going to tell us exactly how many sales we're going to have because of it, that's a fallacy. That's never going to exist, right? And it's just like you were mentioning, can we get 80% of the way there? That's good enough. Can we make decisions with the data? Is it at least directionally accurate to help us make better decisions? That's good enough. Like we're never going to, if we wait until we get to that perfect model, we're going to go out of business because it's never going to happen.
That's it. There's this competitive behavior that it'd almost be like, I don't want to bring this up because it's very nuanced, but a couple months ago I was playing Risk with my family. Like the game doesn't end. It went on for like 5 days. It still didn't end. I almost took over North America and Europe, and then I lost. Oh. I can't sit there and plan my perfect strategy for that game. A lot of what I do is in response to what my competitors do, and their response is in what I do. And there is that constant feedback loop that's not running perfectly at the cycles we want to run it for. And so a lot of these models are just us looking and saying, we're going to try our best today with the tools that we have, with the insights and data that we have, to just be able to do, again, prepare for what our competitors may do or what we're going to see in the auction. And so where I kind of wrap this up is I think all these tools are helpful. I think all companies should embrace them, but I'm not saying that they should be comfortable with error. I'm saying what they have to look at is to say, is your goal as a measurement organization, is your goal as marketers, as a company, to solve some of these problems in analytics? Is this the remit? If you are the company, say, we're going to solve the MMM problem once and for all. Or is your goal to say, my mission is to make our company more money?
Mm.
Those are those two goals will influence the organization. And I can't tell you how many measurement organizations I work with where they implicitly believe that their mandate is the former.
Yeah.
We're the data people. We're going to get this right and solve this and be perfect with everything. And I just wish more CMOs, more CEOs could be like, no, God damn it, make me money. Get me money. I will tolerate your error. I will tolerate your imperfections. And I even know if they say that. Here's what's going to be the collective response from organizations because they've been trained on this. If they're coming from academia, where the quality of these models work, regardless of overall money and profitability, you're going to look at this and be like, all right, so be imperfect, but just make us money. And they're going to be like, what? Like, that's not what we do in data. Yeah, well, that's what we do in business. And so we need to close this gap a little bit, gentlemen.
Right. Yeah. There's something about the well-rounded success of the B-plus student who is able to take on the risks of the world and everything in their college career. They don't just get A-pluses all the time because they aren't just so focused on this one aspect. They aren't thinking more broadly about everything there. And I think to your point, it is understanding what degree of risk tolerance or how imperfect we can be within an organization. And so this is one of those areas where perhaps we as measurement practitioners are the ones actually, we're sort of holding everyone down or we're holding everyone to such a high standard of we all have to do these doctoral thesis defenses all the time being in a room talking about all these complex stuff, and you're just like, that actually doesn't solve the problem. I appreciate that we all want to appear very smart and all those things. But years ago, I started this digital intelligence group in a previous role. And that was as a reaction to having sat in a room with a group of measurement experts who were making an impassioned plea to a marketing leader who just didn't understand what they were talking about. And I saw that firsthand of this core disconnect between, like, this is really interesting. I understand what they're talking about, but the way that they've gone about it and the language they're using is so over the head, and they're seeking such precision that they are completely missing the opportunity. Again, great doctoral thesis defense, but awful business play in terms of making the changes and moves that the organization needs to make. And what happens? Status quo. You don't move on it. You just go, well, we're just going to keep things as they are until you can come back with something that is perfect or something
I can't trust you if I don't know what the hell you're saying.
Right. Exactly.
I know, exception, because everyone's thinking about this. I may not understand what you're saying, but I may think you're really smart.
Sure.
some doctoral sister, I was like, I read their papers and I was like, I was published in a very prestigious journal. I got the first two or three pages. I get the conclusions. Yep. I don't understand a goddamn thing in the middle with the math.
Yeah.
And I'm trying. I'm like, okay. I think I know where you're getting. It goes in completely different. I can read it and be like, all right, whoever wrote this, you're smart.
Yeah.
You're smart. Do we always listen to smart people? That's the question I get to, is that it sounds like the right answer. I want to listen to the smartest people I know. But then we start getting into say, well, wait a minute. Those people are book smart, right? They're not in the field with me. They're not speaking my language. Do I believe these people understand customers? That issue of trust is very real. And Simon, you brought it up. Storytelling is one way we can bridge that trust. It's not supposed to be fluffy or colorful. You're not talking down to people. What you're doing is trying to connect your work, your models, your math, your perspective of the world into a way that relates to theirs.
Mm.
And I would argue it's easier for analytics people to talk in the business language than vice versa. There's some business people. I would not take a core salesperson and say, go convince these people about the technical nature of their models. Mm-hmm. That's hard. Analytical people, you have a hard job to do. We just need to soften it up a little bit so that other people can participate in the conversation and then make a decision to say, not only do I want to trust, but I also want to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're really talking about here, is how do we unlock that additional step so that people believe all the great work that's going on. You don't need to show them how everything works, but they know that if they follow this, they will make more money. I'm all about money today. I don't know. Monday will be my money day. I'm all about the money.
Money Monday.
One of the challenges I think is in play right now is just, we talked earlier about Gen AI, and I think some folks have been calling it Gen BI as it pertains to analytics. Is that a term that both of you are now familiar with or seeing out there?
I'm just waiting for AI, like Web 3, we're going to have AI right. 3, where somebody's just like, 3. Like, I'm just going to abandon all this and this is the next iteration. Everyone's like, oh, you're still doing AI 1. We're on fully, AI. Or like Jack Dorsey went off on that kick for a good couple months. You can look this up if you don't believe me, where he's just like, you know what? Fuck Web 3. We're doing Web 5. And everyone's like, wait, what? And then we all have to learn what Jack thinks Web 5 is. And then everyone's like, well, what happened to 4? Where it's like, no.
Right.
It's just two iterations beyond.
I'm still trying to figure out what 3 is.
Web 3. I'm like, are we still doing NFTs? Or have we moved past that? Because everyone on LinkedIn that was an NFT expert and a blockchain expert is now an AI expert. So I'm a bit confused. Are these one and the same, or did we just...
I think they
just
merged.
Just burn all the old luggage. Yeah.
I'm in a fantasy baseball league with a few blockchain lawyers, and they are still hyped on the NFT train. And they're like, let's make our brackets NFTs. And I'm like, why? What purposes?
Thankfully, you can say that. You can say that 2 years ago, you would have been cast aside. You're not a visionary. You can't see that. Having this picture somewhere on the blockchain that says you own this picture that others can replicate one to one. Where was this going with AI?
No.
It's real.
This is good. Because there's a lot of hype around AI and Gen BI and this idea of being able to ask the analytics, being able to, essentially the fear is push us out of jobs. The idea that you may not need a group of marketing analysts. You may not need this level of sophistication within your organization. And that's a very real scary thing for the next generation looking at this right now. And I think there was a time when I came into the industry when I wouldn't call it the gold rush, but it was close to it. And there was just this big opportunity. There was a lot of open green space. But is that true in the modern era? Or do you think that we are creating an ecosystem where we are going to see gaps appear in terms of the next era of measurement practitioners coming through?
Whenever I see people on my LinkedIn feed start to dominate and calling themselves Gen AI experts, and it's like 80% of my content is how to do prompts for ChatGPT.
Yes.
You create a space in a time where people are interested in growth, in opportunity, and everybody floods into the space. And part of being part of that space is you have to evangelize for that space. This is not an organic thing where you had to win the fight to convince people of the value. It just kind of appeared. And everyone jumped on board and said, I'm an AI expert. And I hate going to conferences where there's people who are like, so what was previously I wrote articles for this magazine, but now I'm all on AI. And the stories are all the same. Let's take the capabilities that are available today and assume that they grow exponentially. Imagine what we'll be able to do next week. And you really look at it, and this is the first thing that I say, is I say, I think the evolution of AI is going to be one of those things where you see a sharp jump and a plateau, a sharp jump, another plateau. I don't think it's going to be linear exponential growth. And if you want just a case study for that, go back about 2 years ago before the OpenAI ChatGPT thing. And everybody was asking themselves, the press kept talking about the forthcoming AI winter. The expectations of AI not being met. They were desperate to say, we've plateaued for so many years. We need that next infusion. And at that point, you started to see what really was an interface with AI that led to that next boom. And now we're taking a moment to breathe. Now, from where Sam and all these people sit, if you want to raise capital and say, where's the value? There's no easier way than going to a CEO and saying, I'm going to get rid of your labor costs.
Yeah.
That's why you want to trust me and buy me. And there's nothing scarier than a practitioner saying, I'm out of a job. Now, what I look at is this is just what we're witnessing in real time is the evolution of a field. That there's just fields that when online marketing came around or online e-commerce, people were saying, at physical stores, we don't need them. You could easily say, real estate developers saying, well, I guess our physical stores are useless. People can buy everything over the web. What's needed? And you can do that for any number of industries. And I think that those fears are real, that marketers will need to evolve with their skills, because there'll be parts that AI will replace. But just like we don't have monks, you know, writing books by hand. It's not to say their skills aren't valuable, but just the evolution of any industry is that these skills will become obsolete and need to be replaced. And where I offer that level of hope is, I think it's going to take longer than people anticipate. I think people think next year I'm out of a job. And I see, you see these stories every now and then where it's like, we've replaced all of our customer service people with chatbots.
Klarna, yeah.
That I think is the pendulum swinging a little bit aggressively for the sake of a keynote or case study bullet point. And I say this just, and I give people this example. They're like, well, chatbots can replace our customer service. All right, good. Who the hell here likes getting a phone menu when you call a company? Tell me what you need. Let's go through six or seven prompts. Or I love when they're like, please explain to me what I need because I know you're going to get it wrong. And how a company like Discover, the credit card company, can actually make their competitive advantage, part of their value proposition. You call us and you get a real person. And everyone's like, oh shit, that's great. And people find workarounds to those systems. And so I don't see consumers necessarily clamoring for AI-generated creatives. I don't see consumers clamoring for chatbots that they can talk to instead of people. I see value in those tools. And for some consumers, it's going to be helpful. But I think that that's going to be a process of gradual adoption and saying, we now have another tool. Will it make some jobs obsolete? Yes. But only if you're going to sit there for the next 4 years and be ignorant of everything and not learn any new skills or different ways to apply it or where there's the roadblocks or limits of AI, then yeah. If you develop none of your skills over the next 4 to 5 years, there is a realistic chance you may be obsolete. And congratulations, that's true in nearly every industry.
Yeah.
If all of us go on sabbatical for 5 years, right? Like I think about this every now and then, I'm like, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to go on a boat. I'm going to breathe. I'm going to come back. If I come back in 5 years, the world will be different and it will be harder for me to find relevance of my skills today MMMs will look different. Privacy will look different. And I'll have to spend a lot of time catching up and say, what do I have as valuable? I will have to do the legwork that I should have started today.
Mm.
And so that's the warning calls. It's not doom and gloom. It's just, congratulations, the curtain's been pulled back a little bit and you see now where marketing might be headed.
Right.
What are you going to do about it? How are you going to be different? Where are the weaknesses of these AI models that you can fit in? And I think that's a conversation that anybody should have about mm-hmm. their industry. Because if you're sitting in a place that's not immediately being disrupted by AI, and you're like, well, I don't need to learn anything new, or my job is fine for the next 5 to 10 years, even if I pick up no additional skills, then I'm going to look at you and my message will be the same to all those people threatened by AI. Congratulations. Technology, people, industry are going to find a way to make you obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's protected. And so it's not unique to AI. I think it just laid a bare for some industries that thought, like computer scientists, I can just write code forever and nobody's ever going to threaten my job.
Right.
Closest threat to them was Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
Right? Be like, oh no, somebody, how do I make this? And now like, oh, this is real. Yes. And that's not a bad thing. You'll have time, but don't let that be an excuse for not doing anything at all.
I love that sentiment. And I think that's a great spot to put the brakes on, unfortunately, and end the conversation here.
No.
But before we do say goodbye, Neil, one thing we like to do is to end the podcast with a takeaway, something that, you know, one thing that marketers and analysts listening can do immediately after listening to the show. They can maybe look up an article or we'll do this for you. We'll pitch the book for you, Converted. You see the lovely yellow, well, if you're watching on YouTube, you see the lovely yellow cover of the book there. I don't have the book like Simon is holding up right
there. Thank you,
Simon.
There you go. But I have props on hand, like, well, I don't know, The Price is Right or something, where they just, there you go.
I don't have the physical.
It's a great book. I've read it at least twice. I don't read a lot of books these days. I'm more of an articles, paper research. So for me to read a full book is a big takeaway, even though I have all these books behind me.
Let me give you them to Jim's question. What article, what you should look to, if not the book. And I'll pass along some advice that I was given a long time ago that's proven invaluable, is if you want to go pick up a book or pick up an article to read, go to an academic journal, Journal of Consumer Research, Journal of Marketing Science, Journal of Marketing, any of those major journals, and there's plenty of them out there, go into them, go through an article and just find an article where the headline is interesting for you. Mm-hmm. Read the abstract, read the first two pages, read the last two pages, where it talks about managerial implications. There's always a setting for it. Mm. And the reason why I bring this up is this was advice given to me. When I left UCLA, I asked some of my professors, I said, what should I do? And she's very clear. She's like, read academic research. And I was like, why? And she's like, because nobody does. They wait for it to be turned into a book.
Right.
And oftentimes the gap between when something is published to when it's picked up by mainstream is 5 to 6 years. If you want to peer into the future, here are some of the best researchers and analysts in the world putting together insights where one estimate put close to $500,000 US in time, in research, in understanding a particular point of consumer behavior that then goes out and is understood only by other academics. And so use that as a way to build into your patterns and into a way of learning to force yourself to read these. And it is forcing because these articles are not written for you. They're written again for other academics, but you'll have a unique list of insights that the rest of the market will not pick up for years.
Mm.
And that gives you a sense as to what can be done, where things are going, with all the data and confidence in the world to say you're ahead of them and you're pretty sure about what they're saying. That's why they get published. And so that's where I would send everybody to. And I know it's boring. People are like, oh, I want something fun. It's not fun, but it's unique and it's powerful. And so that's the advice that I give to people that I mentor, is to say, you want unique information that other people don't have. Here's the best source for it. And most of it is largely free.
I love that. That's such a great mindset, and frankly, an easy thing for people to do. It's not like go out there and, you know, spend 5 hours learning. It's like you could probably dedicate a half hour a week to doing exactly that and come back with maybe two or three papers that are really intriguing, interesting, and you'll have that knowledge, and you'll have those stories, and you'll be able to relay that. But of course, now is the time that we have come to the conclusion. It's always just so wonderful to hear from you. I think you are just a wealth of wisdom, and we're so glad that you were able to join us on the show today. For everyone listening, and if you're sitting out there thinking, oh, I need to keep up. I got to keep up with the Altmans in terms of my focus on AI and needing to do all these things immediately. And I'm always behind and you're so focused on the micro. Then maybe it's time to start trying to see the forest through the trees and take that opportunity to measure up.
That's a wrap. Many thanks to the talented Josh Silverbauer and Jason Packer for providing the theme song for the pod. And if you've stuck around this long, let us know what you think. Leave us a rating and review wherever you listen. And keep the conversation going with us on the Measure Up page on LinkedIn, on our website, measureup.show, or on Twitter @measureuppod.